Like that, actually, I have to say. That's Pink. What a great voice she has. And Walk Me Home. Pink. In tribute to my television. And it's Pink. Which is still going grand, by the way. I've got so used to everything being shades of pink here and there and everything else that it's quite grand. Now, back to those hearings, by the way. Later on, we'll hear from Assistant Professor of Social Work at UCD, Joe Mooney, on a new report critical of the process of disclosing childhood abuse. And we'll speak with a Nace native who's a Nace resident who's a native of South Africa about the ongoing situation in that country, COVID and violence and stuff like that. She's really concerned. We'll be heading back to the Nace Municipal District and, of course, Sports Front, a review of last night's minor defeat for Kildare against Wexford. And live from the British Open, Nick Dye, where the current leaders are still Sam Horsfield of England and Paul Casey, both 2 under after 9 and 7 respectively. As I said, Shane Lowry is just beginning his round in the last couple of minutes, and we'll keep an eye on how he's doing as well for that. Owen, you have a quick more breaking news.
Yeah, indeed. The Independent reporting, claim in the last few minutes, that the COVID vaccine portal will open for people aged between 25 and 29 to register from tomorrow morning. The Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, has confirmed that. Mr. Donnelly said on Twitter, calling all 25 to 29-year-olds, you can register for an mRNA vaccine from tomorrow. As we know, those between 18 and 34 at the moment can register with pharmacists for the Janssen vaccine. And Mr. Donnelly also said that those aged 30 to 69 can continue for vaccination registration if they haven't received one as of yet. But it has been lowered now to between 25 and 29. If you want the mRNA vaccine, which is essentially the Pfizer vaccine, you can register from tomorrow morning.
All right, off you go now. Form an orderly queue. And by the way, there's a nice up on the KFM Twitter this morning, at KFM Radio. And remember, you can always tweet us your messages in regards to stuff as well. There's a lovely photograph of two councillors, Colm Kenny of the Greens, along with indeed Peggy O'Dwyer, who's of course a nurse, qualified nurse, and a councillor in the Clare Newbridge Municipal District. A lovely photograph of them, and all smiles because they're both volunteering out at the Punchestown test centre, which is now a walk-in, as I understand it, as well, to go in and have yourself tested, and it's also vaccinations going on there as well. So nice photograph, and regards and well done to all the volunteers out there, including Colm, Peggy, and not forgetting Dr. Cathal Berry as well, who is working away out there. Now back to those Oireachtas agriculture and marine hearings of the last couple of days. Yesterday we heard questioning of Michael Grassick, CEO of the Irish Horse Race Trainers Association. Today we begin with Matt Carthy putting questions to the outgoing CEO of Horse Racing Ireland, Brian Kavanagh.
Pick up where I left off with the trainers, just in relation to the BBC Panorama documentary that's due to be broadcast this Sunday. I wonder if Horse Racing Ireland could just indicate whether they've been engaging with the programme members. According to the blurb for the programme, it says Panorama discovers that off the track, many horses suffer career-ending injuries, and rather than being rehabilitated or retrained for life outside the sport, race horses that have been owned and trained by some of the biggest names in the industry have been put down, sometimes meeting grisly deaths. So I suppose it would be useful if we could get clarification from Horse Racing Ireland that practice that I've just described doesn't happen in Ireland.
Thank you, Deputy. Yes, we have had engagement with the company over the last, the production company over the last 10 days, as have the British Horse Racing Authority counterparts as well. I'm not aware of any legal challenges. We've responded to queries and hope that will be reflected in the programme, which is due to be broadcast next Monday.
And the practices that I just described that are outlined in the blurb, are you aware as to whether or not they happen in Ireland?
I think it's very hard to be specific about a programme until the programme's been published, Deputy. So, with regard to the specific promotional material you're talking about, I mean, that's very unspecific and general. So until the programme is broadcast, I think it would be wrong to get into a level of detail on something that's going to happen next week.
Well, let me just ask this then. Would it be possible for an injured horse, what would generally happen?
In what sense, Deputy?
an injured racehorse, you know, that's it doesn't need to be put down.
There will be various options in relation to the horse in terms of retiring to the breeding industry in the case of a broodmare or a female horse. In the case of rehabilitation, to try and return back in training, in some cases, in relation to its repurposing for different uses. Horses are retrained for eventing and for other areas, and sometimes euthanasia is the only alternative and is recognised as the best option for horses. So Ireland, probably more than any other country, has a large breeding industry. And a large number of breeding farms in Ireland will be where racehorses at the end of their career end up.
Okay, and would it be possible for any of them to end up in the food chain?
Well, there are processes in place to prevent that, and that's obviously a matter for food safety authorities. There's microchipping and passport identification in relation to horses. Horses that have received certain medications are stamped as being not for the food chain. And clearly that's a cultural issue which is not well regarded in Ireland or Britain, but horses do enter the food chain in continental Europe, as you're aware. But the processes are in place through the passport and identification system to prevent that.
And what about if a horse was ever treated with bute, could it end up in the food chain, do you think?
Not once it's stamped as being out of, not for the food chain. But again, that's a matter for the food safety authorities.
Horse Racing Ireland's Brian Kavanagh responding to some questioning by Sinn Féin MP Matt Carthy, there is a member of the committee. Next up was the turn of, and by the way, these are just excerpts now from very extensive hearings during the afternoon of Wednesday, I think it was, yes. And next up was Dr. Lynn Hillier, who's the Chief Veterinary Officer at the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board. She's also head of anti-doping with the organisation, and putting the questions, independent TD Michael Fitzmaurice.
International research from experts such as Professor Richard Sams in America suggests that there's two methods of hair testing are actually needed. One method for anabolic steroids and the other method for the beta-2 agonists. Are you using two different systems or one system of hair testing?
Our system covers both of those groups of drugs. Professor Sams, Rick Sams, would be a long-standing friend and colleague. He's absolutely right. There are different approaches that can be applied to hair. The essential part of it is you mash up hair into a solvent, you extract the solvent which contains the drugs, and then you put that solvent through a machine and it detects drugs. Now, we're fortunate enough to have...
You're doing both, anyhow, just to cut it. I need to,
sorry,
because I want to get through
apologies.
It as quick as I can.
We're
doing both.
Those. Of course.
Right. Are you aware that there's talk that there's an administration of an injection you can give that basically gives adrenaline to horses before races and could be gone out of them at the end of a race? Are you aware of that, or have you done any looking at it, or is that correct?
There's a number of drugs which can be given shortly before racing in the attempt to affect performance. Adrenaline would be one of them. Cocaine could be another. ACTH, which is a hormone which stimulates natural endogenous testosterone and other steroid production. We are not detecting any of that in our sampling. And that's both out of competition, which is the really important bit, and on race day.
Does the IHRB contribute to international studies on all of this?
We do through our personnel at the moment and through our samples, which are held and stored at LGC. I'd like to do more. I'd always like to do more, particularly in research. And I've been very active in the research field. I'd like to continue doing that. Again, Dr. Pearce is on this call. He may wish to explain further.
Right. And I think in 2017, the IHRB announced the implementation of a race day cobalt threshold in plasma and urine. Did you get involved in that drug testing, or putting money towards it, or get involved in putting research together for that along with other countries?
I was involved in the administrations which contributed to the threshold for cobalt. I've co-authored, in fact, led papers on cobalt detection, and we continue to contribute through our samples to, for example, threshold setting. So just to give that example, threshold setting for cobalt relies on samples from all over the world to make sure the threshold is fit for purpose all over the world. And
okay.
Yes, samples were contributed.
Okay. Can you paint this picture for me? I was just thinking of what you said the last day, that you're going out to, say, some stud farm or where there's horses. Before you go, have you a system that will tell you every one of the animals that's on, or every one of the horses that's on that farm?
That's a very good question. We have a system which will allow us to understand an element of that, but it's not foolproof. At the moment,
I asked a very specific question. Can you, before you go out to a stud farm, say, I have 15 horses, 12 horses, and you have the registration or the that you have every one of them, that you know every one of them, yes or no?
To a stud farm, no.
No. So we have a system brought in place. I asked the question, could horses be moved? So when you're going out to a stud farm, I am aware from information received that both the department and you or the authorised officers have been held up in places. So before they've got into certain places. And what I am saying to you now is you've admitted that there is no system to know, like in, if I have cattle at the moment and I and a veterinary inspector comes to my house, they will tell me every animal I have. If I shift something, it is known I have to put in an application to shift. So my understanding at the moment in this sector is that it's a full paperwork system, and that I could say, well, five horses are gone down the road to Johnny whoever or Mickey whoever, and you cannot say boo to them. Is that correct?
I'd like to go back to the first point. We're not held waiting at yards, and I need to really clarify that. We're not held waiting at the gates. And authorised officer status means that we can hop over the wall.
And sorry for talking over you, since last week, we have whistleblowers that have stated very clearly that you have been held at yards, and that also the department have been held by security at yards.
Part of an investigation onto a yard or a visit onto a yard involves reconnaissance. The yard itself needs to be, you need to understand what exits and entrances you have. You need to make sure that those are covered. So if, for example, the story you're talking about of an animal leaving or moving or being spirited away in a lorry down the back drive doesn't happen on visits where we have that reconnaissance done. So you're completely right. We don't have a movement database for horses in the same way as is present for cattle. We would love one, and we're working hard on that with other authorities, with other groups. But right here, right now, our way to deal with that is to do our homework properly. So when we attend a yard, if we have concerns about animals moving, my officers are briefed to literally park behind the horse lorries, make sure they've gone onto the back gates, just as the department do. So we operate in the same way as the department authorised officers.
But surely Deputy Fitzmaurice's questioning is correct. Like in this modern era, there should be a computerised monitoring of all movement of horses.
That we would love one.
When you go into a yard, whether it's a pre-training yard or a training yard or wherever you go, that you should know going in that gate, there's 6 horses here, 17 horses or 77 horses.
It is what we need.
Yeah. Can I come in on that there?
The AIM
system is up and running at the moment for livestock. There is no reason why ye should have been huffing and puffing over the last number of years about bringing in that system, because the Department of Agriculture, in fairness to them, has one of the most, it's one of the most, one of the best systems, I think, in Europe they have for livestock. And there isn't the numbers of horses compared with cattle and cows and all that. Even sheep they're able to do it down to. And isn't it a ferocious flaw that over the last number of years ye haven't a system in place that before you go out, it puts you at a huge disadvantage. It's not your fault, I'm not blaming you. But why are we looking at this for so long and never made a move? When will that move be made? Who's going to answer that question? Will it be done before the end of this year, that you have like a card, like for an animal, that you have a card in your hand and that you know how many that I have or Jackie has or whoever without even going near that person, and they're accountable, because whether they move or whether they don't, if they're, you cannot say then that they're gone down to anyone down the road, because you have to go through the system of filling the online to change ownership.
Oh yeah. Thank you.
Can you come in on that? Ms. Hillier?
Yes, question for me. The first thing I'd say was I agree with you. I think it's needed. Second question, I think my first week in office, if you like, in 2016, I had a meeting across the road here in Kildare Street to speak to officials about this. It's something that we want. I wouldn't say we've been huffing and puffing. One of the challenges is that horse movement is significant. Horses move a lot more than cattle or sheep in their lives. They could move a dozen times very easily, and tracking that is a challenge. But you're absolutely right. It's not beyond the wit of man, and it is something that we need now. In terms of horses in training, licensed trainers, horse whereabouts on premises, we have a handle on that through HRI databases, HRI systems. Where we have a gap is in the animals which are haven't yet entered training. That's where we'd like to focus.
Quite remarkable revelations coming from that. Dr. Lynn Hillier, who is the Chief Veterinary Officer with the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board and also its anti-doping officer. These hearings were held after concerns raised by Jim Bulger in national newspapers that his view was that doping is a serious problem within the horse racing industry. And those yesterday and today are some of the responses you were hearing. It's two of three meetings. We had the chairman, Jackie Cahill, on with us after the first hearing again after yesterday, and we'll have him back after the third hearing on those and when they issue their findings as well.
Kildare Today with Clem Ryan.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Hello, KFM. Would you wish Mary and Joe Smullen a very happy wedding anniversary today? Love from Mam, Patty and Trish Birmingham in Hazel Hatch. Also, I'm told a great turnout at the convention centre last night in regards to what you might tell us as well. Morning, Clem and your listeners. Having been the first to raise this issue, says Councillor Aidan Farrelly, regarding what was happening in Mullen Park in Maynooth. I welcome the news of a U-turn by Raith. It's still, however, not a day for celebrating. Homes starting at €395,000 is hardly affordable. I understand what you're saying, Aidan, but in regards to that, but you know, the fact that 115 houses plus 20 for Kildare County Council are not going into the hands of international investment funds, I think that's good news, and hopefully there'll be much more of that around the country as well. Sean Innes says, morning Clem, you brought up an item that councils are not spending their budgets on travellers. What about the old people who paid their taxes all their lives, can't get what they're entitled to without jumping through the hoops? Travellers don't subscribe anything. Well, Sean, we don't know that. You're saying they go around nine people. I see your native county didn't do well, Clem, last night in the Minor Hurling Championship. Sean, it's unbelievable that the Cork Minors beat the Clare Hurling Minors 6.28 to 6 points. Jesus. I've got to get home for the weekend and sort that out. Now, it should be said, that team had no training sessions during the year, no manager, nobody over them, and they were just cobbled together and then set down to be slaughtered by Cork. At least that's the excuse anyway. Owen.
In top line in the Irish Examiner yesterday, that many adults who make a disclosure that they were abused as children said if they were starting over, they wouldn't do so because of the process involved. A majority of those who had made retrospective disclosures also said they were not told that their information would be shared with someone else during the assessment process. The findings are included in upcoming research carried out by Dr. Joe Mooney, Assistant Professor of Social Work at University College Dublin, and Dr. Mooney joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Dr. Mooney.
Good morning, Owen. Thanks.
Like I said there from the outset, this is rather worrying. I know you've carried out extensive research in this area for years now, but the majority of adults, or quite a lot of them anyway, who make those disclosures said that they wouldn't do so again.
Yeah, so I suppose what the study was specifically looking at was engagement with the child protection services to make what are called retrospective disclosures. So this is where an adult who has experienced sexual abuse in childhood comes forward to make a report of that. And we have a somewhat unique internationally sort of a policy context here in Ireland whereby an adult who does so, even to a counsellor or psychotherapist, via mandated reporting is that then channeled into our child protection system. So it's their experience of engaging with that system and the sort of headline of them maybe not wanting to do this if they had a chance to start over is in relation to engaging with that system. But there is a general sense we see from Josepha Madigan's comments in the Dáil there earlier on last week that a lot of people who experience sexual abuse find it very difficult to come forward for very many reasons. And she went so far as to say she would take the statistics we have around sexual abuse and violence with a pinch of salt in that regard, and I very much agree with that.
Well, I mean, the effect that abuse can have on children or younger people, obviously, is enormous. And it takes a lot of courage to come forward, regardless of how many years after the abuse has happened, that you come forward to report it. So it's surely not good that the people are being discouraged to come forward now by the way that they've been treated or the way their complaint has been handled.
Absolutely. And I mean, the international literature would stack up that responses to disclosure at any stage are of critical importance, not just for the well-being of the person themselves, but for their ability or experience of disclosing into the future. So that's particularly relevant when we're talking about children. But we do see that people tend to delay disclosure. The adults surveyed as part of this research tended to delay or not disclose until 10 years after the experience of abuse. And that happens for many different reasons. As you say, there are significant barriers to coming forward. There's societal shame and stigma, but also those systems that are tasked with responding to sexual violence, particularly childhood sexual abuse, they're not, I suppose, accounting for the needs, the particular needs of those people coming forward who are affected by abuse. It's getting better, but we still have a long way to go, and this study would show us that adults didn't feel like they understood the process, having been contacted by the child protection systems. They didn't feel there was a clarity around what would happen once they hand over their story. They weren't receiving updates. They weren't receiving information around supports. And particularly in the context of GDPR and data protection, which is a hugely significant and sensitive area of practice, particularly around sexual abuse and violence, they weren't sure if their information had been shared, and the majority of them weren't told if their information would be shared. So that's a significant concern coming out of this piece of work, albeit a small anonymous survey. It can't be generalised, but the experiences that were shared are legitimate and genuine.
Yeah, just one final point then, Dr. Mooney, on this, and I've had a read of the blog that you did on it, and people can check that out on irishsocialwork.wordpress.com. It's very interesting, but you touched on it there, and I just want to flesh that out a little bit. The understanding of the process and the being kept up to date part of it, because a majority of those respondents said that they participated, they felt as though they weren't kept up to date. And also, we say to people, if you have been affected by child abuse, come forward, report it, and hold the perpetrator accountable. But a lot of people might think it's easier said than done because the process is quite lengthy.
It is very much easier said than done, and we need to ensure that any system that an adult or child comes into contact with is facilitative, is encouraging, and is supportive of that person coming forward in the context of all of the dynamics that we know exist around or potentially exist around sexual abuse and violence. It has to be acknowledged that the process with regards to child protection service in Ireland has been under scrutiny for a number of years now, and TUSA and welcoming it, so are under reviewing their current policy, which is the child abuse substantiation procedure. I would hope that there is a significant stakeholder input and consultation in relation to that review. And I suppose despite cyber attacks and COVID, this issue predates both of those areas. We need to have comprehensive training for social workers. We need to have a comprehensive, clear and published policy. And we need to have victims and survivors at the centre of both of those.
And this is just a snapshot of it, of course. You have a forthcoming report coming out on the 8th of October this year. Registration details for that event available in early September 2021. And we might get you back on the programme to discuss that in more detail when it comes out. But for the moment, Dr. Joe Mooney, Assistant Professor of Social Work at the School of Social Policy, Social Work and Social Justice at UCD. Many thanks for joining us on the programme this morning.
Thanks very much.
Thank you both, gentlemen, for that. Just a quick request. Can I wish Adele Doyle and Dean Websdale getting married today? All the best, guys. Looking forward to a great day from Carmel and Rhea. You know, when people who got married to date over the last 18 months look back on their anniversaries and their weddings, so many people will say, oh, what a pity. It was COVID. COVID will dominate that. We couldn't bring everybody that we wished to the weddings and so on and so forth. But I suppose much more serious than that might be issues around people dying or whatever. Let's take a quick break. After that, we're going to hear it from a South African native living in Nace. We're going live to the British Open and reviewing last night's minor hurling game.
Kildare Today with Clem Ryan.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Juanita Perumal, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Now, did I get your name right? It is Juanita, and is it Perumal?
It is correct, except I'm married now, so my surname is Mudli.
All right, okay, I understand that. I love your South African accent, by the way.
Thank you so much.
And you're very, very welcome. Juanita, you're born in South Africa. Your husband is South African, isn't that right?
Yes, that's right.
And you're living in Nace. Give us
a little
background as to how, like the Swallows, you came all the way from South Africa to Kildare.
Absolutely. So my husband's in IT and we are young people with three kids. We actually had our third here. And we just decided to do something different with our lives and live in another country, experience another lifestyle and travel. And so we've been here in Nace for 3.5 years now.
All right, and you're very welcome, I might say, as well. I saw that wonderful film the other night on Nelson Mandela and the World Rugby Cup. What an amazing man he was.
He was, indeed.
Incredible, and what an amazing bit of acting as well in that film, I have to say. It was brilliantly done. Unfortunately, in recent days, you've become very concerned about events in your home country.
Yes, we have, yeah.
What's concerning you?
So, since Sunday evening, there's been an unrest in certain parts of South Africa. The major problem being in a province called KwaZulu-Natal, which is where both my husband and I were born and we spend most of our lives in, and both our immediate families live there and extended families. And it started off with protests and support for our ex-president Jacob Zuma, who was, you know, who wouldn't appear before the High Constitution.
And he's been jailed, actually.
And he's been jailed, and he was found guilty of many accounts of fraud and corruption.
Yes.
And he is from the Zulu Kingdom, which is KwaZulu-Natal, and so obviously most of his support is from around there. But, you know, this was kind of just the beginning. So it was the protesting, and then it went on to full-on criminality and...
We've seen those pictures on the television with the army being called out again.
Exactly, and it's very violent.
And even more concerning is that the jailed former president hasn't exactly issued any statements calling on his followers to calm the situation. You're obviously very concerned about your family. When were you last back home?
2018
was it? Of course, the whole COVID situation is quite rampant in your country, just as it is in our country as well. By the way, we'd like to thank Maura McNamara, who put us in touch with you.
Yeah,
and she set up a South African organisation, Nace International Women's Group. But a Nace International Women's Group.
She's been amazing. We've got a little group going that Maura set up, and it's just a few women from different parts of the world, and we kind of, you know, meet up once a month if we can, you know, just to have a coffee and kind of just, you know, chat about our lives and our experiences,
yeah,
and kind of, you know, hear each other's stories, and so that's been amazing. That's
and
been,
you know, she's a wonderful poet as well, and she has been on air with us here in the program.
She's beautiful, yeah.
And Juanita, back to the issue of concern for you, because Owen, my producer and co-presenter, tells me that when you ring home to chat with your parents, you can hear the shooting in the background.
So, so just to give you a quick, you know, besides the political thing, this is pretty much the reality right now for most South Africans living in either KwaZulu-Natal, for the most part, and Gauteng, is that, you know, since the unrest, there's, you know, they're having to live through an entire day and night of constant explosion, gunshots, screams, just a sense of fear, a sense of not knowing if they can actually get through the next day. My mom had to queue outside a supermarket for 5 hours and then get turned away because there was actually nothing on the shelves. This morning I chatted to her, you know, it's their winter, it was dark, she was there again at the supermarket, you know, queuing with hundreds, I'm talking like maybe between 200 to 300 people, trying to mask up, trying to social distance, trying to get the supplies that they need, signs everywhere saying no food, no fuel. It's just been harrowing.
Absolutely. Your line's just breaking up a little. Listen, when we're so concerned with COVID in this country, and when you bring into play what you're talking about, the impact of COVID in South Africa, and indeed the appalling scenes that we've seen on our television screens going on over the last couple of nights, it really brings it home to us when we speak to someone like yourself, whose family are caught up right in the middle of all of that, the worst violence in Kuala.
And that's kind of what we were hoping for. You know, we were hoping that, you know, when people watch this on the news, and there's quite a significant community of South Africans here in Kildare, and, you know, just to kind of, I think, firstly, just pray for South Africa, and, you know, around your dinner tables, around your homes, kind of just, you know, spare a thought for South Africa, and just, you know that beyond the statistics and what you see on TV and the looting and the criminality, that there's actually families, there's
of course
fathers and sons protecting their neighborhoods, and, you know, families trying to protect their kids and just trying to get through another day.
Well, we certainly will, and people will pray for you, your family, and your fellow South Africans as well. Regards to your husband Rodney and yourself, as you say, working in IT, and also we'll say hello to a couple of other South Africans, Alistair and Estelle, who own Books.ie out in Toker's Estate.
Lovely.
So we have that lovely South African presence here in the county, and you're so welcome. And Juanita Paramal.
Sorry, I just wanted to say one more thing, is that to whoever's listening, you know, to the area and the Irish community, if you can kind of just reach out to our local politicians here, our foreign minister here, to kind of engage with South African government to, you know, help the South African families that are there, to, you know, do whatever you can, just to create more awareness around this.
That
would be so helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Juanita, it's great talking to you. Wish I had more time, and I think we'll touch base with you again as we keep an eye on how things are developing in South Africa. That's Nace resident and South African native Juanita Paramal chatting to us there. And this gives me enormous pleasure to say welcome back to this gentleman, Nick Dye. Good morning.
It's been far too long, Clem, but hello from the Open Championship.
It has been far too long indeed. Nick, whose voice so familiar to our listeners over a course of a number of years, but not in the last couple of years, because, as we say, like major international sports, the issues arose around rights issues, who can broadcast this, who can broadcast that. But all of that is in the past. Nick, you sound great again. How have you been?
Oh, things change. I'm rusty, throaty as well, even though I haven't done an awful lot just as yet. But hey, it is good back. Be back and try to test the knowledge and see what I can remember.
Well, indeed, I'll tell you what. I know that you have a huge pressing engagement to deal with in regards to radio stations right around Europe and even around the world. So we'll let you bring us a quick update. Is Sam Horsfield still holding the lead at the Open?
No, it's Brian Harman now of the United States, who has missed the cut on his previous four visits to the Open, twice a winner on the USPGA Tour, good player, obviously, in the top 50, but a surprise leader, and yet you often get that at the Open, don't you? He's birdied four of the first five holes, so don't know what he had for breakfast, but a four under par, he's two strokes clear of the field, but it is pretty much a logjam on that field as things stand. The whole of the field that are out on the course, separated by some eight shots or so. Shane Lowry started in his defence 2 years late and found the rough on the off the tee on the first two drives. So sadly, this rough is really matted. He's been struggling that little bit. He's back down at two over. But Darren Clark, the last man to win here at Royal St George's, he's back to level par after an early bogey, so going all right for Darren.
Well, I have to say, Nick, it's fantastic speaking to you again, Nick Dye, and we'll chat to you tomorrow morning on the programme at 10:45, and then on Saturday Sports Beat and Sunday Sports Beat, we'll have regular reports from Nick throughout the afternoon. Keep it up, son. You're doing fantastic. And we'll send you
We'll be all right. We'll be polished by then, won't we?
We'll send you some lozenges for that throat. Nick Dye, great talking to you, Nick, and thank you so much again at the British Open. News of the other Irish, by the way, is that Pádraig Harrington goes out at 12:42 today, and McIlroy is going out later in the afternoon, sometime around 3 o'clock, and we'll keep you posted on all those particular scorelines and how the Irish might be doing at Royal St George's. Rory McIlroy is going out at 21 minutes past 3. And a reminder again, we'll speak to Nick around the same time tomorrow morning, and then tune in to Saturday Sports Beat with Owen Beattie, Sunday Sports Beat with Paul Power, because we have two major big matches commentaries for you, but we'll have those early updates live with Nick Dye at the British Open. You can't say we don't try our best for you. Let's go to a man who's just absolutely useless at golf, and that's Ger McNally.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not one of my many talents, unfortunately.
Ger, that minor game last night, Leinster minor game, against Kildare against Wexford. Again, a very creditable performance by the minors in the first half. But then, just like the under-20s earlier in the week, it got away a bit from them in the second half. The score, again, really not a reflection on the huge development going on in Kildare hurling. And I'm not being patronising about that. It's not so long ago since we'd be afraid of putting Kildare hurling teams on the same fields as the Wexfords and others.
No, it's no coincidence that the game followed a very similar pattern to the under-20s match on Tuesday against Offaly. Again, it was the Kildare side who matched their opponents for at least three quarters of the game before a kind of a spell, a fresh side playing the first championship game against a side who had suffered a couple of really tough games to get to that stage, and the stronger side kind of pulled away down in the final quarter. And it was very similar again last night, and it was only really a 10-minute spell really that settled the game. Wexford scored a goal and 8 points without reply through that spell in the second half, and that was the difference really at the end, because the first half was nip and tuck. Wexford actually scored a goal after 15 seconds from the very first attack of the game, but Kildare responded really well. They were level by the water break and went ahead then with the first point out of that water break from Alan Tobin. Wexford came back and got a couple of scores. They were leading going into first half injury time, but having conceded a goal in the first 15 seconds of the half, Kildare then scored a goal in the last 15 seconds of the half when Seamus Kelleher got a touch on a high ball in from Killian Harrington, and Kildare went in 1-6 to 1-5 ahead of the half-time break. Wexford nudged ahead again early in the second half by a point, but Kildare then went through for their second goal. Alan Tobin sent through in the 37th minute, and he shot home into the back of the Wexford net to put Kildare 2 points clear. And at that stage, we were dreaming and hoping for another Kildare victory over Wexford at underage level, but in fairness then, Wexford really did step it up to the gears.
They got away from them despite a late Kildare goal. Let's hear from the manager, Owen Stapleton.
It's funny because we went through the calendar today. We started our trials on the 10th of May and we picked our panel on the 15th of May. And we met the following weekend for our first time as 32. And 8 weeks later, we're here. And we would have liked it. It's COVID, so it's nothing to do with any. It's nobody's fault. You'd have liked another 8 weeks with them. But you can see you're close, but you're just not cute enough. You don't have enough matches played at pace. Couldn't stay with them. We needed to stay with these boys. Because you stay with them, you worry them. We have enough hurlers. Like some lovely kids in there. Just to keep them hurling, you know. But it's disappointing. Two bad days for us.
Well, you know, Chair, he's echoing what Pat English said, that Kildare have the hurlers and definitely the capability to step up to the big time. It's just that they need more of these type of games.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the flip side of it. I mean, ask any manager who's developing young players, and they'll tell you that games against the top sides are what players need to develop. But at the same time, they need some sort of rest as well. Like, these games have been run off by a week. Like, you know, that's almost saying there. They've only had them in for eight weeks there in terms of training, playing some challenge games, and getting two championship matches in before last night, then as well, their third game as well. So it's been a very hectic schedule for them. But, I mean, 8 weeks out of the year is not a huge amount of time to have those elite players and have them kind of in training and playing against the best. And if these players are to fulfill the undoubted potential that they have, because, you know, it's not patronising to say that Kildare now are able to, you know, be disappointed this week to have lost at under 20 level to Offaly and have lost last night against Wexford at minor level. I mean, that's a big step forward to even be talking in that sort of language.
Well, let's hope that on Saturday the seniors will have full commentary with Chair and Mark Maloney of the seniors relegation Joe McDonagh Cup game, 3 o'clock in Parnell Park on Saturday. Full commentary here along with the rest of the afternoon sport with the lads Mark Maloney and Ger, and then on to Sunday in Croke Park, Johnny Doyle, Peter McConnan and Ger for the Leinster football semi-final, Kildare against Westmeath in that game. Sure, an old fella like yourself is having a very busy schedule, Ger, but I'm sure you're doing a great job in keeping up to it. I have to say that, and well done you. Alright, and, thanks for that, Ger. We'll be previewing the weekend games tomorrow morning. Also, well done to the Kildare under 16 girls team yesterday evening, because having trailed Meath at for long periods of the game, they were 3 points down at half time, 2-7 to 10 points. Two late goals brought them a great dramatic win, 2-17 to 2-11 in that game, which was played in Hawkfield. The goals, those late goals, coming from Edwina Birchill, and I think you'll guess the name of Grace Murta, and yes, another one of the Murtas, sister of Lauren, I presume, daughters of Johnny, and not forgetting the mammy as well in regards to that. Okay, that's all we've time for, but Owen has a funny text.
Yeah, this came in to us yesterday from a listener, Clem, and it's just brilliant, right? Have a listen to this. It's about the outside pub drinking laws. So it's, you can go inside the pub to get outside, then sit inside a covered area as long as it's outside. You can go inside to the toilet, but you can't go to the toilet outside. You can go inside to pay, but you must stay outside to drink. If it rains, you can sit inside the covered area, but only if it's outside. If you decide to go home, you can go inside the pub to get outside, to walk home, to be inside again. You can walk past the bar to go to the toilet inside, but you must not carry a pint back outside. This is only safe if it's done by the bar staff. Only bar staff can take a drink outside to you while you are inside the covered area. You can sit on the floor outside at the park or the beach and get a coffee or food from a stand outside. However, you must sit and be served at a table if you are at a pub area inside, even if it is outside. You can sit with six people, unless you have a big family, then you can sit with as many people as you like. A meal no longer protects you while drinking, and the virus no longer comes out after 10 o'clock, but that's only if you're outside. We hope we make things clearer for you, and we look forward to seeing you.
Good man, Owen. I love it.